Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Professor Sinha, Professor Bergsma, for the invitation to participate here again in Delhi. And it's a privilege, of course, to look deeper at what underpins our previous visit, which examined the historical foundations of international criminal law. And to some extent, I will link these two. I'm going to look, as our chair said, at the prince and the people. So the paper traces the philosophical foundations of sovereignty from the conclusion of the 1648 Peace of Westphalia, right, through the Western sort of post-Cold War new political dispensation that inferred a post-sovereign era, sort of in which some international law elements impinge on state sovereignty. So contemporaneously, I then argue that philosophical disposition also reflects historical experience. You know, so for example, in China, sort of the exercise of foreign sovereignty is at times associated with external intervention, quasi-colonialism, and catastrophic levels of armed conflict and accompanying casualties. We see some of this rhetoric and narrative here in India also. In the West, of course, by contrast, as some of the speakers have already pointed out, impingement on state sovereignty by international law is viewed as a critical sort of moral triumph by some and compelling adherence to norms and rules. But of course, as the previous speaker said, who constructs these norms, these rules? What do they mean? How are they enforced? And so what I do is I compare to some extent the philosophical dispositions of Bodin and Machiavelli. You know, so of course, Bodin on the one hand cites the Bartholomew massacres in France as demanding a sovereign with absolute power. So philosophically, Westphalian conceptions of sovereignty, you know, he also acknowledges deriving from religious conceptions of a higher unlimited power residing in the sovereignty of the state. So I firstly trace Bodin's conception of a such well-ordered power as necessary to control unruly behavior within sovereign French territory, power to be respected and adhered to internally and externally, based on a body politic comprised of both ruler and ruled. So I then weigh that against Machiavellian's attribution of less consultative, centralized power to a prince, enabling internal contestation to be quelled and individual rights to be subordinated to that of state interest. So a greater concentration of power. Sort of, and both approaches emphasize, of course, state unity, but suggest alternative approaches for achieving it. So what I then do is I trace the legitimacy of international criminal law via Hobbes's conception of the people's establishment of this body politic to inform endowment of civil, legal, and other powers to a sovereign that can then representatively cede sovereignty to law as under the Vienna Conventions. And I consider governments' representativeness of people and then their consequent legitimacy in ceding or protecting sovereignty, including in relation to core international crimes adjudication. And so it draws on some of the work, and I should have said at the start that I'm here presenting in my capacity as a research fellow for the Center for International Law Research and Policy. My comments don't represent the perspective or the role of my work for the UNDP or the World Bank. But nonetheless, I still link this conception of provided sovereignty by the people to this process of how consultative, you know, who are the victims and what role have they actually played in firstly the design and of law, what conduct are we prosecuting, as Morten noted in his presentation, and who designs and selects these institutions of enforcement. My colleague Georgia and I are looking at this issue of victim participation in a lessons learned study. So would an informed and engaged population support the ceding of such sovereignty, and in relation to criminalization of which conduct? Right. So to consider these issues and their significant consequences, I argue, we must return to critical philosophical debates surrounding whether state action is informed by structure, anarchy, and the distribution of power, sort of process, and that's the interaction and learning, and institutions. Right. And can international regimes constitute a central sovereign power amongst sovereigns? Or does it simply reflect unrepresentative sovereign competition, right? So we have this even greater problem of how representative, right? We have this problem when the sovereign decides to establish a process. To what extent is this exaggerated by multiple sovereigns then coming together and deciding upon a process that determines what conduct will be tolerated, what will not, and how to enforce. So I link this philosophical debate to debates that we're seeing in international criminal law and political science. And of course, this common assertion is that that we see in some strands of the discourse is that international criminal justice is becoming stronger. And Catherine Sinking, perhaps most notably, makes this assertion. She calls it a justice cascade. And she says that after enough states adopt the norm, international pressure without domestic pressure procures various levels of conformity. But what levels, right? And how does participation shape these different levels? And surely we need a greater level of specificity to make such assertions about conformity or non-conformity. She says that victor's justice is no longer necessary. She cites expectations that demand prosecutions in a global sort of cosmopolitan normative society. To substantiate evidentially her claims, she cites the number of prosecutions, this explosion in the number of prosecutions. So, of course, I say it's not the quantity, it's the quality. And how do we determine quality? We look at known or alleged conduct, and we then say what conduct is excluded from prosecution and what is included, right? And this goes specifically to how independent is a court from political pressure. And of course, the philosophical question here is, does the body politic comprise the ruler and the ruled, right? As Bodin and Hobbes to some extent assert, or is participation singular, right? An autocratic prince. You know, and what does that mean for the legitimacy and the representative of the sovereign ceding of power to international criminal justice institutions? I then consider this idea of the narrative this interdisciplinary tension, right, of rhetoric, political science, history, and philosophy. And here we have this issue of the linguistic production of these imagined and conceived of events, right? That, of course, as we know, take on a life of their own. To what extent do they generate and regenerate meaning through the power of the metaphors of those that are doing good? And how novel are we with these constructed narratives? So when I attempt to look, through this lens at international criminal law, it asks us to reconceive, you know, what we conceive of as justice, of course, and this is, you know, a much greater debate than we have time for here, but just as one example, we have this complementarity, right? A principle of complementarity. And think about that that linguistic construction, right? A principle of complementarity that means, as Catherine Sickink would say, you know, this is driving an explosion of international crimes prosecutions because domestic actors are taking on this norm and prosecuting themselves. But of course, we look back at the history of how did complementarity come to be there. And this was this negotiation between different actors, strong states and weak states. Of course, weak states being afraid that a continuation of these ad hoc tribunals would continue, right? Where they would have no power over the control of whether jurisdiction would be imposed, right? And would I be the next Milosevic, someone that is viewed as expedient by the United Nations permanent five members of the Security Council? No, we want complementarity so that we can put in place a process and we control when jurisdiction is triggered or not. And here, of course, I would take issue with our colleague, Professor Sinha's comments about the African Union and the fact that these African states have triggered jurisdiction. Yes, they have triggered jurisdiction, but look at who is triggering jurisdiction and who is pursued by the court, right? In every case that is cited, Congo, Central African Republic, Uganda, Cote d'Ivoire, where the state itself has triggered the jurisdiction of the court in every situation, they have been able to engage in calculated cooperation in order to direct the prosecution and the case selection of the court at their adversaries without any indictments of government actors. So here it requires that we think about which philosophical dispositions we in the discourse are adopting. To what extent do we have confirmation bias? And then how is that informing, right, these historical narratives that we're constructing? So I'm calling here for an enhanced level of interdisciplinary engagement to inform what forms of philosophical foundations we see in international criminal law and its enforcement. So I already spoke to some extent to the design of the of the ICC, these negotiations, and of course Morton already mentioned in his remarks what conduct do we prosecute, and he noted the emergence of crimes against the peace after World War II. Of course, you know, we saw other attempts to prosecute that conduct earlier, but than Nuremberg. But he identified the extent to which this crime has fallen away. And when we look at this negotiation between states at Rome, we see the narrow self-interest of governments protecting themselves, embodying a narrow level of participation that did not necessarily reflect what we might consider the self-interest of the populations they purport to represent, right? Populations that would also wish for them to be protected from those very governments, yet those governments wanted to protect themselves from prosecution, of course, were they to engage in conduct that threatened the security of those people. So we had, of course, powerful states on the one hand seeking to exclude the crime of aggression, and we had weak states on the other hand seeking to obtain some kind of insurance policy that allowed them to protect themselves from prosecution. And we saw that in complementarity. And of course, the weak states gave up these jurisdictional filters that we see over the crime of aggression, but we do not see over the other crimes on the Rome Statute. But then if we look at this emergence of international criminal justice and the trajectory of international criminal justice, I say we have this Del Ponte moment, right, where the norm of independent assertion of prosecutorial discretion to prosecute all conduct, at least that is on the within the jurisdiction of an established court, was asserted, and I say this is the height of international criminal justice in the post-Cold War era, where Del Ponte, after her predecessor, Louise Arbour, had ceased an investigation into the shooting down of President Habyarimana's plane in Rwanda and demonstrated a level of deference to power. Carla Del Ponte did not demonstrate that same deference. And of course, as we know from her memoirs and my own interviews with a number of those senior actors in the Office of the Prosecutor, she was told by the United States government, stop investigating the crimes of Paul Kagame and the Rwandan Patriotic Front, or we will remove you as prosecutor from the Rwanda Tribunal. She refused. And she was removed. And I say this was the high point of assertion of independence of an actor reflecting the more Hobbesian, Bodin philosophical orientation of representation of all constituents in international criminal law enforcement. And then we saw a move back towards control by power, by the prince. And this is how we've seen the narrow instrumentalization of international criminal law enforcement reemerge. Not that it was not there in the ICTY and ICTR previously, but it encountered this confrontation, and it has now moved beyond, and the prince has come back. And I say there are sort of two factors that are driving this embedding of the prince. The first, and we see them in the shifting global economic order, that is shifting power in the world as well. And that is having consequences for the enforcement of international criminal law. And I say the first is that weak states are seeking to take power back, right, from the Security Council. And we see this in the African Union application of pressure to the ICC. And I believe someone made comments yesterday that, well, Kenya and other countries have been threatening to leave the ICC, but they haven't. And there was some inference in the comments that there was some altruistic intent, you know, behind this. And I would argue no. It is not in their realist self-interest to leave the ICC, right, for the ICC to fall down, because they would then see this complementarity insurance policy, the power would go back, or the pressure upon the United Nations Security Council and others to start enabling ad hoc other international criminal justice institutions would reemerge, and they would lose control because they would not be at the table. Instead, they would be on the menu. Yes? And the other function I see here is this more assertive role by emerging powerful actors that we see in the shifting global economic order, and we're seeing it manifest within the United Nations Security Council. Yes, so we have the Libyan case, And post-Libya, we have a much more forward-leaning Eastern permanent members of the Security Council in the obstruction of Security Council triggering of the International Criminal Court. So this, of course, also exaggerates the extent to which weak states are able to take back power, because they see that the ICC, Office of the Prosecutor, is not going to receive work from the United Nations Security Council, which renders it more dependent on African governments to and other weak state governments to provide it work by triggering its jurisdiction. And that renders the Office of the Prosecutor more accountable to those governments and ensuring that when they do open an investigation and select cases for prosecution, they must do so with an eye to the preferences of government. Because if they do not, they will send a signal to other governments who would then refrain from referring situations and triggering the ICC's jurisdiction in the future. So how much time do I have, Chair? Thank you. So maybe I'll skip through this. But in effect, what I say is this Hobbesian idea of the body politic and participation, the ceding of sovereignty back to law, we could see it, right? Were there domestic justice processes that could compel the cooperation of the state with these international criminal justice institutions, right? At present, we have a system constructed as such where, yes, the Security Council could make findings of non-cooperation. The ICC itself, as in the Kenyan situation, can make findings of non-cooperation. But to what extent do these actual ostensible constituents, the citizens, the victims, to what extent are they able to use domestic enforcement mechanisms, the courts, or other processes to compel cooperation by the state? And I take this case of Sierra Leone as emblematic of the concentration of power, right? A prince saying, how will we use one of these courts? And I give you here kind of the broad outline of that case, where we have this special court for Sierra Leone. We had in Sierra Leone the British government supporting the government of Sierra Leone against rebels, who were supported by neighboring Liberia, amongst others, with Gaddafi in Libya and Blaise Compaoré in Burkina Faso. And of course, the British government wanted to see the United States government turn around its support for Charles Taylor, and by extension, these rebels in Sierra Leone. Right, and this was the Clinton administration, and they went and they played domestic politics in Washington, D.C. They went and engaged Senator Judd Gregg, a Republican from New Hampshire, who held the chair of the Foreign Affairs Appropriations Subcommittee in the Senate. They said, look at the horrible things that the Clinton administration is supporting in West Africa, of course. And they said, you control the budget, you know, including for the United Nations. Senator Gregg said, yes, this is awful. Of course, it's coming to the end. This is in 2000, the end of the Clinton administration. And he said, I can block payment on $1.7 billion the United States owes the United Nations. And he did so until he had a meeting with Richard Holbrooke, who was then ambassador to the United Nations. And Holbrooke said, OK, release this money. We'll change our policy. We'll get rid of Charles Taylor. And we'll support and make sure that these rebels are defeated and this government stays in place in Sierra Leone. How are you going to do this? Tomorrow, we'll increase military aid to Guinea. Guinea will launch an insurgency into Liberia against Charles Taylor. We'll increase CIA and USAID support for the political opposition within Liberia against Charles Taylor. We'll set up an investigation into Charles Taylor's role in the conflict, and we'll set up a court that will that we will then provide all the evidence incriminating Taylor. And then when that court indicts him, we'll be able to get multilateral sanctions on Taylor through the Security Council, which severely constrains his capacity to fight back against this insurgency, and will accompany the bilateral sanctions we'll put in place tomorrow. Right? So this is, and one of or a combination of these elements will have Taylor out of power. You know, is that sufficient? Yes, I will release the money tomorrow. done. The prince makes his position. The institution is put in place, and international criminal justice goes on its way. So we'll skip here to the end. Others have talked about the relationship between international humanitarian law enforcement, the crime of aggression, and this emerging norm of the responsibility to protect. You know, I see this as a very dangerous interaction. And we can talk about that in the comments, but I'm being told to wrap up. And so in my concluding slide, you know, I think this requires us, to really go back to a deeper consideration as we were challenged to, I believe, by Professor Bergsmo in his comments yesterday, right? To first look at philosophically, not just participation, but who benefits and how from prosecution of what conduct, and how are these different conducts related to one another? Environmental crimes, crimes of aggression, financial crimes. Of course, money laundering enables the material support of armed groups, and the concealment of certain forms of conduct. So the interdependence of these omitted crimes from international criminal justice enforcement. And very finally, the tension between, just to reiterate, the tension between inclusion and international criminal law enforcement. The objective and perceived horizontal inequality. Right, so it's not just inequality writ large in a society, but inequality specific to social groups. This is one of the key findings as a driver of conflict in the forthcoming joint report between the World Bank and the United Nations on conflict prevention to be presented to the General Assembly next month. What role is international criminal law playing, particularly in its arguably discriminatory and selective enforcement, in elevating or diminishing perceived injustices, right? Specific to social groups, with particular social groups within a conflict say, oh, we're the ones being persecuted because it's just our leaders who are being prosecuted and not those that did the crimes to us, you know, and vice versa. So I believe I'm right on time. I should conclude. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.